Good afternoon, brethren. It's very good to be down here in southern Ohio with you.
Hold just a minute,
I hope to begin a series, tape series and written series, entitled Debunking the Myths of Sacred Namers. And this concerns, of course, the myths that have developed since the 1930s through sacred name groups that are now impacting Church of God groups in a major way concerning the sacred name, as they say, Yahweh and Yahshua. As most of you have experienced, I'm sure, in this fellowship, within the last year, you've come across someone who's used the name Yahweh, either in your presence or on a tape, or you've heard it over the radio, or you've read it somewhere, or you've heard the name Yahshua. Well, there are those who have been in our fellowships, but they're Church of God fellowships, but not in our immediate fellowships. They're Sabbath keepers, holy day keepers, even though they may be keeping the holy days on different dates, who are going to the use of Yahweh now and the use of Yahshua. One fellow in particular is teaching that we need to be rebaptized in the name of Yahshua, that the name of Jesus is a pagan name, and the name Lord is pagan, and Joshua is not Joshua, but Jehovah, they say, is a monstrous, hybrid, a hideous name that has come down to us that actually is the name of Satan himself, and if you use the name, you're actually praying to Satan. So this series is a series that I hope will begin to blunt some of the inroad that these people are making with our brethren and help our brethren have a means of defending themselves in a simple way whereby they can hear what this brother or sister is saying and retort in a kind way, in a Christian way, with an answer that will begin to blunt the thrust of this evangelism that's coming into our midst. I know of some churches, especially ex-CGI churches that are splitting right down the middle over sacred name issues. There are older fellowships that have come out of the worldwide, that have gone independent, that are being affected by sacred name groups all over the country. I'm sure many of them I haven't heard of. There are Canadian churches that are being split, being taken over sacred namers. And the doctrines of some of these groups, such as the Kingdom City group, the YNCA group out of southern Missouri, are not only on the internet, but they're very active in evangelizing. They're also Sabbath keepers. They keep the holy days, albeit different times. But these people are very zealous. I'm sure they're very sincere. They have put together quite a body of literature that's now coming into our groups and beginning to circulate. Now, some of these people who are pushing this information are doing so through organized committees of Churches of God, that is, especially the independent Churches of God that have left the Church of God International. And they're beginning to influence these groups to study this material from these sacred name groups. And the way the material is written, it's written in a very intimidating, a very dogmatic way. And it sounds, at first, like they know what they're talking about. They don't know what they're talking about. And as we'll see in this series of studies, the basic assumptions they're making can be rebutted. But you have to have some history. You have to have a little help. And with that help, you can then educate yourself and sharpen your sword, load your ammunition, and get ready to take care of the false doctrines that are coming into the church. This paper that you have in front of you today, Debunking the Myths of the Sacred Namers, is just part one. And it concerns three myths. Now, there are dozens and dozens of myths that these people are involved with. Two of these myths I addressed a little bit at the Feast of Tabernacles in Middlebury, but I'll just go through them again, and you have written form here. We didn't have that at the feast. I've since gone back in the last 2 weeks and thought it through a little better, I hope, and have written a few basic points down that'll help deal with three of the basic myths that they will throw at you when they first meet you. And as Ed Moore was saying, there has to be a way that we can come back with something that's truthful and yet simple that'll throw them off guard, knock them off their saddles, and when they pick themselves up and dust themselves off, maybe they'll start to think a little bit, because a lot of these people aren't convinced when they first get into this, but it sounds good. And so if we can nip that in the bud at that time, we can help them a great deal, because once people are bitten by this spirit, it's very hard to get out of it. I don't know of anyone in my 40 years involved with the Churches of God as an active in the ministry for a good part of that time. has ever come out and repented of Sacred Names movement. But I have come into contact with youngsters who've grown up in the Sacred Name movement who are most interested, even though they've grown up in it, in seeking for truth. So if we can help them and blunt it at that end, if there's hope there, we surely can with our own people. Because they're just like sheep walk, not that they're dumb, but they're just all like the country boy in the city. You walk in and see the bright lights and everything looks good. This is the way a lot of our brethren are with these false doctrines. And Satan dresses it up to look really good. So the first myth is one that they usually begin their material with. And in fact, one of the booklets is entitled The Mistaken J. They teach that there was no letter J until about 500 years ago. Now by that they mean just that, no letter J. And their belief is that since there was no letter J, the name Jehovah is translated out of the Hebrew by Tyndale in 1530. He was the first to transliterate it, rather, not translate it. That the name Jehovah was therefore impossible. The second myth is tied up with that, and you'll see that listed over on page 5, that there is no J in Hebrew. Now, they make a big ado about this. They'll get up and on their hind feet and dance around and really intimidate you that there's no J in Hebrew. Some of the arguments they will use, in fact, a good many of them, have nothing to do with the Hebrew at all, with true biblical Hebrew. As we'll see, they intimidate us by leading us to believe that the Hebrew of the Bible was Yiddish. It was not. And that the Hebrew of the Bible somehow had something to do with German pronunciation. There's no J sound in German, therefore there's none in the Hebrew. That is not true. God did not write the Old Testament in German, and there is a J sound in the Hebrew. The third myth that I'll address this afternoon is the name Jehovah was invented. So they'll come back and say that the name was invented in the 1520s, and oddly enough, depending on which sacred name group you get involved with, they'll say it was invented in 1516, it was invented in 1518, it was invented in 1520. Well, I wish they'd make up their minds, because it can't have been invented at all. It wasn't anyway, but they can't agree among themselves as to which date it was invented. As you'll see, this is the longest part of the paper. But as we get into this, and if, I hope I have time to finish it this afternoon, because there's a lot of reading, and the reason I want to read a lot is that the tape will become separated from the paper, and there are a lot of people who may never get the paper, or once they get the paper, they will have long had the tape, and therefore, even though the two will become separated, they'll still have the material and the references as this tape begins to circulate. And it will begin to circulate. I made a tape a year and a half ago in Detroit for a small fellowship, Church of God, independent in Detroit, in a Salvation Army building on 13th or 12th Street, wherever it was, Mile Road. And the next thing I know, I'm getting a 12-page letter from a sacred namer in Atlanta, Texas. Now, I'd never heard of Atlanta, Texas before. And so I looked it up. It's a little bitty place somewhere in the middle of the cacti country. And this fellow was livid and was trying to take me apart at the seams for what I had spoken to a Church of God group in Detroit. So I know it's going to get around. And that's okay. They can help me write the book. As they begin to receive the material and mention the pros and cons, well, then I can address that, because there's, as I said, this is the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more that I've compiled over the last 4 years. It's on my computer. I have about 1,000 or 1,500 pages of documentation that's cross-referenced, that's on about a foot and a half or 2 feet on my shelf, and I'm adding to it daily. People keep sending me material. And God willing, when this gets out, it'll help draw the line with those getting into it, and even though it may not help those who are already into it, my purpose for writing that is not to convert sacred namers, it's to help our brethren. Now, if God adds that as an extra blessing for them, well, so be it. But this is for you people. This is for you who don't believe sacred names, and to be able to help those who do. Okay, the first myth. There was no letter J until about 500 years ago. And I hope, in a Christian spirit, to have some fun with this. Ed Moore mentioned this kind of thing, that there's no reason why we can't have good Christian fun in the process of exposing some of these errors. Even though this is serious business, God has the best sense of humor in the universe, or he wouldn't put up with us. He would have squished us a long time ago. There was no letter J, they say, until about 500 years ago. Well, the letter J first appeared about the year 800 AD, and these are round figures. The letter was invented by French monks, and the French monks invented the letter to represent a sound. Now, all of this is not in the material that I've written down, so I'll try to amplify as I go along. But as you read through this with me, annotate this and take notes, then this will help you further with the background. So it's like the argument is like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? Sacred namers will argue that without the symbol, there is no sound. Well, without the sound to begin with, there was no need for a symbol. So the sound came first, the symbol came later. So their argument that because there is no physical J, as they see it today, as they look at the letters and see J, they say, well, therefore, since there was no J before the 1500s, it was impossible for the name to have been Jehovah. That's one of the arguments they make. The sound was there, not in English, but close to the island of England for 200 years before, almost 300 years before William the Conqueror set foot in England. And the symbol J was there, the small J, the small character. And you can see it in their writings. These were Latin-speaking Catholic monks who invented the character J in the 800s. Now, because they were Latin-speaking Catholic monks, does that mean the letter J is pagan? No. No. No language is sacred, no letter of itself or no sound of itself is sacred or unsacred. It's what we do with it. It's how we use it. It's what we teach. It's what we believe. It's how we put everything together that makes it good or bad. But they will argue that because this came out of Catholicism or came out of France or out of early English, that therefore it's pagan. It's not the, as they will argue, the sacred language. Well, the idea that Hebrew is a sacred language was invented by Kabbalistic rabbis and first written about in their Targums, that is their paraphrased comments on the Old Testament in the 2nd and 3rd centuries AD. They were the ones to first begin calling Hebrew a sacred language because they believed that God, their God, made the entire universe out of the letters of the Hebrew characters and that it began with four special characters, J, H, V, H, the letters of that are transliterated Jehovah, and that God made the universe and everything, all the powers, all of us, out of beginning with those. Actually, there are three characters there because two are repeated, the H is repeated. So out of three Hebrew characters, and these same Hebrew characters are vowels, they believe the entire universe was created from this alphabetic soup. So therefore, if you can get the name just right, out of the sacred language, you can call down the powers of the universe and use them. Brethren, that is magic. That is the magic of Satan the devil himself, and when you have a sacred name of any sort, a sacred language of any sort, you are calling on the higher powers, all right, but they're the wrong higher powers. You're calling on the wrong God. You're calling on the wrong servants of that wrong God. And it's been the experience of some of the rabbis and others over the, as is even recorded in the book of Acts. Yes, they've called down these powerful demons, and the demons just about destroyed them because they didn't get the name just right. So on their incantations that you can still read, they've been translated, they have these magical formula that if you say it just right and use the sacred name just right and babble in tongues just right and dance just right, and use the right chemicals and the right herbs and put everything together just right in the right cave with the right lighting and with the right time of day or night, that you can call down the spirit and it'll do your bidding. If not, that spirit can come down and destroy you. Our brethren who are getting involved with this do not realize they're calling upon Satan himself and his minions. And by the time they learn, by the time Satan exposes his fangs to the sacred namers, it's going to be too late. He'll devour them totally at that time because he is the god of this world and he's a vicious god who is out to destroy all of God's plan if he can. But we have to have ammunition, we have to have the sharpened sword, we can arm ourselves and we can therefore defend ourselves. Now I've given a lot of background that I had not intended to speak about right here at this point, but I think it ties in. So the letter J itself as a small character came into the English-speaking community at the time of William the Conqueror. So the symbol there was there, the low, the small case. There was no uppercase symbol until the late 1500s, early 1600s. Does that mean that the sound wasn't there? The sound was there since the time of, in English, since the time of William the Conqueror. Now, maybe the sound had been there among the Anglo-Saxons before. I don't know. I haven't gone that far. But we do know that it goes back to the French-speaking peoples of the 800s. So by the time the capital J shows up, it's already in the early or mid-1600s. And based on that, sacred namers will argue that therefore the name Jehovah was impossible. So what I've done, and this is where the fun begins, I believe, in the proper way, I've typed out part of Tyndale's work in Exodus 3, 18 through 23. And I'll read part of this at this point and then go through and comment on the material I have from Tyndale. Tyndale published his translation of the Pentateuch in the year 1530, and this facsimile that I typed out is taken from that. The following example of his translation is taken from Exodus 5, 18 through 6, 3. The first and last verses are not completely quoted because that's the page I have and was working from, and it, so it bled over on the previous page and the page subsequent, and I didn't have that material handy at the time. Notice that the lowercase I in verse 21 below and the two uses of uppercase I in verse 3 of the following chapter, in each case, are representing the sound of J. They both do. So for hundreds of years, at the beginning of a word, followed by a vowel, I represented the sound of J. Now, if I were followed by a consonant, it represented the sound of a vowel, like Israel. And you'll see that as we go through this material. So it's starting in chapter 18. Sacrifice unto the Lord. Now the word unto is translated out of the Hebrew, out of the Masoretic Hebrew by Tyndale, using the letter V. So if I were to read this literally as the sacred namers would have me read it, sacrifice unto the Lord, go therefore in work, for there fell. They weren't using the S at that time for the leading S, although they had just come in, the small S had just come into the language because of the printers. So if I were to read it literally, fal, it should be shall. No straw, because it looks, for years, the S looked like our F, when back into Roman times, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years back, and it was still in the language. Ftra begiwan. The U was used for the V sound. U. Now notice, Y-O-U. Tyndale, in translating this, knew of and used Y with the Y sound. So he wasn't thinking of Yehovah when he translated it. It was purposely transliterated, rather, not translated, transliterated Jehovah. The U sound was, the Y sound was there. He uses it right here with the word Y-O-U. And yet, fi, or si, that ye deliver. Now I know Moses had a lisp, but Tyndale wasn't going back that far in transposing Moses' lisp, the trouble Moses had. Deliver the whole, H-O-L-E, I find that interesting. He didn't even use the W at that time. Tally, T-A-L-E, of brick, B-R-Y-C-K-E. Now, verse 19, when the officers of the children of Ephraim, there's the capital I before a consonant, actually it's the S, Israel, saw, and literally it reads fa, them filthy. You know, some of these words are still so colloquial that to us, you have to go back and compare it with the King James and figure it out. And he even mentions the cafe here. Of course, you can translate that out into the English. In other words, they didn't have enough straw. In that he said, you shall mind nothing of your delay making of brick. very hard to read even in the English at this point. Then they met Mophis, Moses, and Errol, Tonikin. That sounds very strange if you try to read it literally. You have to go back to the King James, and I'm sure those who are, I'd recommend those who are listening to this later on, go through the King James with me so you can follow through and figure out what I'm trying to say here. And I won't go on other than to pick out in verse 21 the word judge. Obviously judge. Tyndale meant it to be read that way. It's I-U-D-G-E. Judge. Here the small I is before a vowel, judge. So it's the J sound. And then later on, down in chapter 6, at the very in verse 3, I am the Lord, Tyndale translates, and I appeared unto Abraham, V-N-T-O, Isaac, I-F-A-A-C, Isaac. There you have the capital I being used as a vowel before the consonant S. And I-A-C-O-B, Jacob. The capital letter I used before a vowel with the meaning of Jacob. Well, later on, the printers tweaked the bottom of the capital I and turned it into a J so that it represented the sound that it had all those centuries. That's all they were doing. The sound came before the character. And Almighty God, but in my name, Jehovah. Now notice the U, the capital I at the beginning, E-H-O-U-A-H. As we noted before, the U was used for the V sound at that point. And shortly after that, it was divided out. Okay, because printing came in, because of the necessity to standardize it, the printers then added these symbols to represent sounds in their language. Any scholar, like Tyndale, or Ruslan, Bruchlin, or Gallatinus, whether they were Catholic, Protestant, or neutral, any Hebraist or Hebrew scholar, regardless of his German upbringing, his English upbringing, or his Italian, or his Greek upbringing, wherever they were, when they were taught the Hebrew and how to pronounce it, they would imitate the pronunciation of the teacher. They wouldn't pronounce the names as the Germans would pronounce it. They wouldn't pronounce them as the English did, necessarily. In other words, all of them were imitating the same sounds that they heard from the Hebrew grammarians who came out of Spain. These were not Yiddish grammarians. The Yiddish community had just begun a few hundred years ago. It was Kabbalistic. They were biblical illiterates. In almost all cases, they were Talmudists. And beyond that, they were Kabbalistic, which is the esoteric part of Judaism. And they were actually, many of the rabbis were teaching their people in the synagogue that it was a sin to read the Hebrew, the scripture. They taught that it was a sin to read scripture. The Sephardic, Levitical Jews who had preserved the Masoretic text for hundreds of years were the ones who presented the grammars and gave the grammars to the early Protestant and the Catholic scholars. So the sound came out of Spain. It didn't come out of Germany. So there was no possibility of the sound being yeah for the Hebrew character jot. Impossible. That only became a possibility at the turn of this last century when Jesuit scholars posing as Protestant scholars in this country and in Europe, and Germany and England in particular, illegally changed the phonic system, and when they introduced it to the English-speaking world, it was though this had been there for the last 400 or 500 years. They introduced a modified Yiddish phonetic system and dumped the Sephardic system. We'll see that under the next myth. This translation by Tyndale shows the double use of the small I in the centuries before the letter J was invented. In those times, I before a consonant, as in Israel, represented the I sound, and I before a vowel, as in judge, Isaac, and Jehovah, represented the J sound. Thus the J sound was represented in the English alphabet from the earliest times. Notice also the use of V to represent the vowel sound U, as in unto, us, deliver, drive, and the use of U to represent the consonant sound V, given, have, favor, and Jehovah. After Tyndale wrote this translation, the use of U and V was reversed, U came to represent its present vowel sound, and V its present consonant sound. They both have the same genealogy. They both go back and trace back the symbols through history. And they begin to break apart at this time and be solidified as a vowel or sound or as a consonant sound. Sacred namers use the invention of the letter J, lowercase, to argue that Jehovah is an illegitimate spelling of the Hebrew J-H-V-H. And what you see there in the Hebrew with its vowel pointings is the name that is in the Hebrew that is actually used this way for more than 6,500 cases in the Old Testament. They view Yahweh, or however they say it, as the only correct way to spell and pronounce the divine name. They are completely ignoring the fact that the English letter W, used in the name Yahweh, was invented 200 years later than the letter J. So as Ed was saying, and I'll mention his full name. If I could remember his address, I would put it down here too so you could write him. But as Ed pointed out, I'm just kidding. Ed pointed out, this is the kind of ammunition we need, and I'm so glad that he said this because it reset my BB up here. Every now and then you got to get a knock on the head and reset the BB straight and set me on this path to help write this material so that our brethren can use it. So thank you, Ed. Thus, the same argument that they used against the name Jehovah could be used even more strongly against Yahweh. And if we're armed with that, then you can come back with the touche, or whatever the French used to do, parry and quarry and argue and touche and all that stuff, and they're left dead in the water. Now, I said we would have some a little more fun with this. Let's take this a little further. The use of Y, as we know it, small y, small letter, was not invented until about 1500. The small letter A, as we know it, was not invented until 1500. The small letter H was not invented until 1500. E was there as it is in its present form, going back to the 300s, 400s, 500s A.D., out of the latter part of the Roman Empire. The capital Y was there from the 300s. So out of the name Yahweh, only the capital Y and the E are legitimate. You end up with Ye. Not Yahweh. You end up with Yeh. Or Weh. Or what, you know, however you want to pronounce it. So you see how we can take an argument, taking their argument, throw it right back at them in good Christian humor, and maybe a little bit of righteous indignation, depending on how hot they get and how hot you get. I don't know about you, but I've got enough Scotch-Irish in me and tinged with German and Welsh, and I don't know what all. But you put them together, and we have a Donnybrook. Sometimes you get me cranked up, and you can tell I'm getting mad because my ears start to get red in the lower lobes, and it rises to the top to a full boil, even though it may not show in my face. It'll come out in the words. Even if you get that point in the argument, hold your ground. Hold your ground because you're right. Linguists will testify to this. So we can argue the word Yahweh was impossible before 1500. It truly was. Now we can take that a step further. And last night I was thinking, wouldn't it be fun to have wheel of fortune game out of this? Kind of that concept, you know. Ed was talking about Jeopardy. And Wheel of Fortune just sort of fit. You spin the wheel, and it comes on a certain amount of money, and you say, is there a vowel? Or is there a consonant? Or you buy it. You know, whatever you do. I don't watch those shows that much, so I probably get that part of it wrong. Let's take the word Yahshua that they're throwing at us all the time in the context of the capital Y and the rest of the characters. Okay. What are the consonants and vowels of the name Yahshua? Well, it begins with the Y, right? Capital Y. So that was back in, you can trace that back to the, to I think 114 actually AD. But the Romans only used that character when they took a word out of the Greek language and used it in Latin, and they would use the Y to represent, the capital Y to represent that Greek word, which goes against sacred name arguments even there. What's the next character in the word Yeshua? A? Okay. Help me out, folks. I can spell a little bit, but I got to get this right. Okay. From Y, A, is it? Okay. H, okay. When did the A, the small character A, come into use? 1500. Okay. So if you were playing, when was the name Yeshua legitimate? Give me a Y. You could have a Y, capital Y. Give me a small A. Give me an H.
S.
Oh, S. Yeah. Yeshua, yes. Give me an S. I told you have to help me. There goes your money. You're bankrupt every time you turn around. Next thing, it's all zeros across your little screen. Give me an H. And what did we just read about the U being used as a vowel? Joshua. It wasn't used that way until after the 1500s. It was still used in 1530 for the V sound. And what do we have at the end? Another and another because of the small A and the small H. So there's only one character that we can say yay, and all you end up with is a Y, is a capital Y. So out of Yahweh and Yahshua, we end up with ye and yeah. That's all they've got to stand on. So yeah. Yeah, you're wrong. You don't have it. So as we, at the U used in the character U used in the middle of the word would be the consonant V at this time of when they were saying that Jehovah is an illegitimate name. You can make up all kinds of names out of this. We've got them. Don't you see? We don't have to be afraid. We don't have to wonder about this term Yahshua. Mary never heard the word Yahshua. Never. She never heard the name Yahweh. You know, she did not at all. Gabriel didn't speak to her in that language. They were using Greek, by the way. They weren't using Hebrew at that time. Hebrew hadn't been used for 300-400 years. In fact, it was more than that, because Ezra had to translate, paraphrase out of the, in the 500s, when he started translating and formalizing the Old Testament, he had to translate out of the Hebrew into the Aramaic dialect for Hebrew, so-called Hebrew-speaking peoples, 500s B.C., and they began to use Greek in the 300s after the time of Alexander the Great, and were using it at the time of Christ in Galilee especially. They were all raised with Greek. Peter was, all the disciples, Christ himself was. They spoke Greek. It was the most Greek-speaking part of Palestine. It was the the commercial center, the temple was the bank in that area. The Levites down there were the great bankers. But it was the commercial area where Matthew was sitting on the commercial routes and taxing people coming and going. And all those records had to be written in Greek. They were filed that way in Greek. Pardon?
Do you want to be recording all that?
I think I am. Thank you. I hope I am. I took it off pause there, yes. Pray for me, as I said. Keep this thing straight. I need something that's automatic or have someone do it for me to keep me from messing it up. So we don't have to run in terror. We don't have to. We can tell our people a few simple ways to defend themselves. It's like jiu-jitsu, where you're using their speed and their energy and their force, momentum to your advantage. And next thing you know, they're lying on their verbal back, looking up at you, saying, "What happened here?" One minute it's Yahweh, the next minute it's yeah. And it was Yahshua, and now it's, there's not much left. Okay, myth number two. There is no J in Hebrew. All right, myth number two. There is no J in Hebrew. Unlike Yiddish, which modern Jews speak, the Hebrew language that was spoken by Abraham and Moses, and I say this very sincerely because this is what all the scholarship recently and going back for 100 years verifies. The Hebrew spoken by Abraham and Moses was, and that is preserved in the scriptures, does have the J sound. So there is J as a sound in the Sephardic phonetic system, in biblical Hebrew. not Yiddish Hebrew, not Ashkenazic Hebrew. Now, there is no physical character, J, in the Hebrew, but there is a character representing the J sound, and that's Jot. The reference for this concerning Abraham, the Hebrew of Abraham and Moses, is from a Baptist scholar who's still alive, is publishing. In fact, he published an introduction to the biblical Hebrew syntax in 1990, and he informs us in the about 150-page summary leading into the grammar, tracing the Masoretic text and how it was preserved as consonants and then marked with the vowel sounds. He verifies that in the Semitic languages, and we have records of them going back 2000 B.C. to the time of Abraham, Semitic languages, in other words, back to the Tower of Babel, really, because that happened just shortly before Abraham, that the best way to preserve a language is to have it consonants without vowel symbols. That preserves the sounds better than having the symbols. When you do add the symbols, then it's like tacking on a Morse code where they're set in cement forever. And those symbols they fit the philology, that is everything about the language, the Semitic languages, that shows that the sounds could not have been faked. No one could have come in at any time in history and stuck the wrong vowel points under Jehovah and give it this, what they call a bastard sound. It would be impossible because it wouldn't fit with the language itself. It's an impossibility to fake it, not have it obvious. In fact, where they did fake it, God made them leave a little note off to the side, Kilroy was here. If you know what I mean. Because it doesn't add up, it doesn't fit the language, and any scholar coming along later, anyone knowing the language, would know that. So that God made them leave a little note to tell on themselves when they changed Jehovah to Adonai, literally taking the characters out and switching them around. Yes, they're called emendations of the Sopharim. They were done in the 2nd century B.C. by the Levites who had, as you read Malachi, who had begun to devalue and defame God's name. And so they're the ones who God forced to leave a note for generations to come, that their sin would be right there in the margins of the Masoretic text. So from ancient times, the J sound has been represented by the letter Jot. In ancient Hebrew, and you see the backward F there, that was Jot before Ezra changed it to the Assyrian, that's Assyrian or Aramaic square text of the Jot you see later. So that ancient character, by the way, goes clear back to the time of David, the earliest. There are records that go back to David's time. So when you're reading in Samuel about Jonathan and David, as we were, Mary Kay and I were talking about this morning, this was the Hebrew they were using. It had the same sound. And many of the characters, by the way, in ancient Hebrew look very much like modern English. With just tilt them up, straighten them up, turn them around a little bit, and they look very much like modern English characters. Very, very much. Uncanny. Although Ashkenazi Jews, and these are German Jews that came out of Poland and out of the Slavic countries, and that's the basis of their language, have changed the pronunciation of Jot to the Y sound, the Sephardic Jews have retained the original pronunciation of Jot as J. The Sephardic phonetic system is acknowledged by scholars as the most accurate representation of the ancient Hebrew, biblical Hebrew. So when I use biblical Hebrew, I'm not referring to synagogue Hebrew. I'm not referring to Yiddish Hebrew, whether just common, spoken on the street or used in synagogue for liturgical purposes. This was biblical Hebrew that you would look at when you would look at a manuscript from which Tyndale translated and the other early scholars. The grammars written concerning that Hebrew are totally different, and the phonic system is totally different, and they give a representation of it below here. As are all languages, Hebrew letters are classified according to the organs of speech by which they are sounded. Your tongue, your teeth, your lips, and then the ear passages as the air is used and started and stopped as you goes through the mouth. Sephardic grammarians have divided the Hebrew letters, biblical Hebrew, into five classes of sound: gutturals, labials, palatals, linguals, and dentals. Now, the one we're most concerned with here is the palatals, because that's where Jot fits. We're not, in this session, we're not talking about the W sound. But they changed the W sound and changed the W sound, changed the va to a wa, and they changed Jot to a ya. But when they moved literally moved the Hebrew character, like jot, out of the classification palatal. They moved it to a new classification for the English called a sonnet. That's where the y sound is in the English language. It's called a sonnet. There's a sonance that's there. So it's as the mouth forms, you say y. They moved va, the Hebrew character va, out of its proper classification as a labial. If you look down here, you'll see the second character, that's wa, that's va. Under labials, reading from left to right, that Hebrew character is va. In the Sephardic system, they moved that symbol down to the new sonnet system, and it became wa. So they changed it from a labial, va, where you use one of the lips, va, the V sound, to an English sonnet, wa, where you don't really bring your lips together, you just sort of purse them, and wa. And there's a, like a, I guess they would call a plosive, where the air is forced out at the end, wa. So they moved that, those two characters down, to justify the illegitimate name Yahweh. Always before, the scholars have pronounced it Jahwe. Now here's another place we can, or Java, we can have some fun. I really believe, and I see you know where I'm going already, that the ancient, these people came out of South America, the Jahwist, and worshiped the ancient god of coffee, Java. Okay? I think you get the point about the language. Any grammarian, Hebrew grammarian, and Hebraist worth his salt always pronounced it the J sound and the V sound. You find it that way in the ancient literature going back hundreds of years. You don't find the Y and the W until very recent times. And that's quite a story. That was a culmination of 300 years of work of Jesuits trying to take over and ruin the English Bible. See, they have to destroy the veracity of the English Bible before they can bring their own Bible in. And all the Catholic Bibles now have Yahweh. All of them. Starting in 1966. Published from Jerusalem. They're the Yahwists. So you know where they were going from the very beginning. And by the way, the scholars who promote, the so-called scholars as we'll see who promoted these changes, have direct links not only to the Catholic Church and Jesuits, but have links to Kabbalists as well, going back into the occult. Calling down demons and taking the doctrines of demons and bringing them into English-speaking fellowships and services. They had destroyed the Anglican Church over 100 years ago. So when we write in, Fred writes in Lord, What Should I Do? About the destruction of Protestantism, the Jesuits had all but destroyed Anglicanism and had taken over 100-130 years ago. Now they had to set out to destroy American Protestantism, so they shifted everything at the turn of the century, published their material in English, began to hit the American English-speaking peoples with full violence, and it came down through Princeton and Harvard. They were the main conduits. It was mainly Princeton through which this came into this country, from Oxford. Well, they'd taken over Oxford a long time ago. And so through these so-called scholars, this new phonic system came in, the new push for Yahweh, came in, not Yahshua at this time. They hadn't resurrected that yet. The name was invented back in the 1500s by a fellow by the name of Johann Ruchlin. That's a different myth, a different story. But it comes out of the magic of Egyptian, Kabbalistic, it's like a soup, a terrible soup. You take all the evil of the past and throw it together in one witch's brew, and these characters were it. They were it. They mesmerized the world and started changing everything to the point where now most Americans, even though they might be small little fellowships, are using the wrong Bibles. They have the wrong scholarship, the wrong commentaries, the wrong biblical dictionaries. Everything supports this evil, and none of them have stood up to at least that material that has come down to us. If they did, it's been destroyed. So if God lets them, this will be destroyed too. You know, it just either gets around and people begin to see it and it gains currency among our peoples and begins to help, or if God allows it because they don't want it to get around. I'm exposing the king without his clothes, as Anson and I were talking about last night and this morning. They're naked. They have no clothes. But they argue as though they have the the pomp and the ceremony and the dress of King Henry VIII. And they're standing there naked before us and before God, but their arguments, their clothes, in other words, to use that metaphor, really are empty, hollow. But they have all these idols of literature that are around there, and they've suppressed the rest of it, suppressed the history. And so our people go down, or anybody goes down to a library, and they have none of this. It took me 4 years to dig this out. 4 years to even get to this point. So anyway, you'll notice the jot under the palatals, this, again, the second character, that little, the smallest of characters, it looks like a comma. Palatals are consonants voiced with the aid of the palate, of course. There are three different types of palatals. The first type is made when the part of the tongue just behind the tip is raised against or near the hard palate. The English Y in yes, yes, or the German ich are made in this manner. A second classification of palatal is the fricative sound, which is made on or near either the hard or soft palate. Fricative palatals produce the sounds sh and z in the English. The third type of palatals are the affricative sound. The English J